Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. In the South, barbecue time doesn't just mean summertime. It's all the time. On this week's show, we're cooking up the pig in every way you can imagine. First, Ryan Fertel addresses the state of whole hog barbecue, a dying art crafted by a very special breed, something he discovered while researching his book, The One True Barbecue. Then we talk salt curing meat with author Jeff Roberts, whose book, Salted and Cured, follows the origins of the practice to its current renaissance. Finally, it's time to dissect the pig. No one does that better than boucherie chef Nathaniel Zimmet. He welcomes us into the kitchen for the deconstruction of a whole hog. There's no way around it. We're going whole hog on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Ryan Fertel, and I am the author of The One True Barbecue.
While writing his book, The One True Barbecue, Ryan Fertel observed the intense physical labor of whole hog pit masters at work. Surprisingly, he was reminded of his own mother at work. You see, Ryan spent much of his childhood in the Lafayette location of his grandmother's restaurant, which was managed by his mother. Who was his grandmother? None other than Ruth Fertel, founder of Ruth's Chris Steakhouse. Ryan shared this memory of his mom, Rosemary Parisi, who was the first to show him the toil and beauty of a butcher's work.
The saw and the meat, combined with the promise of smoke and fire, did more than excite a version of Southern exoticism within me. These rituals unlocked a deeply held memory. I was instantly and quite uncomfortably put in mind of my mother, who, in one of my earliest recollections, I could see slashing through a short loin with an electric bandsaw. Her thriving steakhouse, and this was the days before prepackaged cryovac steaks, cut the following day's quota of New York strips, fillets, and ribeyes. When any given employee became a no-show, my mom took up his position, even if that meant being the butcher. It was brutal, violent work, not maternal in the least, and the next 15 minutes went by in the blur and the whine of the saw blade. By the time Gabriel had stopped reveling in the rendering of pig flesh, 12 disembodied trotters stood piled in the truck's bed. I was sickened, I was thrilled, I was hungry.
Through stories told in artful prose, Ryan's book takes us through the best whole hog barbecue joints in Tennessee and the Eastern Carolinas, pillars of a sustained tradition whose numbers are dwindling. We sat down with Ryan to discuss his exhaustive research on the book, a process that led him to some of the smokiest storied barbecue shacks in America. Ryan began by describing Ricky Parker, one of his all-time whole hog heroes.
Ricky was a man, a pit master, a barbecue cook that I met in the summer of 2008. I was working for the Southern Foodways Alliance. They had sent me to West Tennessee to document barbecue culture. And there in Memphis, I ate barbecue almost every day that summer. I ate barbecue sometimes five times a day. I didn't necessarily enjoy myself or fall in love with barbecue as a thing. I didn't love barbecue too much before that. But in Lexington, Tennessee, where Ricky Parker's Scott's Barbecue restaurant was, I found something completely different, completely new. Ricky was cooking whole hogs. So these are entire pigs. And Ricky, he was never content with cooking just one. He was also too busy to cook just one. So he would strive to cook as many as possible. He would cook a dozen sometimes over a weekend night. His great goal in life, he told me over and over, I'd visit him every year after 2008, was to cook 100 whole hogs over an Independence Day weekend. And so I, after that first visit, fell in love with his food, but also kind of fell for the guy. He was a bit of a character. I never knew if he would be open. He was in and out of certain dependency issues. He liked to say that he was married to his restaurant more than he was to his wives. He thought that he was the last of the great whole hog pitmasters. In a sense, he was right. He grew up in that part of Tennessee, West Tennessee, just about an hour and a half, 2 hours east of Memphis. They didn't cook shoulders. They didn't cook ribs. They cooked entire pigs. But in the 70s and the 80s, these places start to disappear.
Why do you think, because obviously you bought into this, why is whole hog barbecue the one true barbecue?
Yeah, so the title of the book is The One True Barbecue. A better title might be My One True Barbecue, because whole hog really became my thing, my passion, my obsession. Ricky liked to say that a whole hog contains every part of the pig, and he's right. So when you go to Scott's Barbecue today, it's now run by Ricky's two children, you can really order any part of that animal. So you can pick a little bit of shoulder, a little bit of ham, a little bit of belly meat, a little bit of tenderloin, and you could have this mixed and matched. You could have a little bit chopped or sliced. So you're kind of imagining the perfect sandwich. Mm-hmm. I think he's right. There's something about the sustainability of eating a whole animal. He didn't talk in those terms. But there's something about being able to eat anything you want off of this carcass.
Snout to tail. Walk us through the families across Tennessee and the Carolinas who really dominate whole hog barbecue. Who are these people?
Well, when we think of family history and barbecue and whole hog barbecue especially, we got to talk about the Jones family in Naden. Pete Jones opened the Skylight Inn in 1947. He was a teenager. He was a teenager in a agricultural town. He didn't have a lot of prospects. And so he opened what amounted to a bar room serving hamburgers and maybe the whole hog barbecue that his barbecue forefathers had cooked before him. So he opens this place. You know, it was never really popular. It somehow remained open. It fed people very cheaply. This was an agricultural town. This is where people would go for a beer and a bite of barbecue and coleslaw and the cornbread after work. But then in 1970s, National Geographic comes by. So National Geographic sent a pair of reporters, a writer and a photographer, on the road. And they are traveling around eastern North Carolina. They're looking for the best barbecue. They're eating bite after bite of barbecue. They're liking what they eat, they say. And then according to the Jones family, according to Pete Jones, this was the story he always told. And if you go to the Skylight Inn, it's written on the walls. This is the story they'll tell. The reporters come into the Skylight Inn and they say, "Sir, we've heard you have some good barbecue." And he says, "I think I do have some good barbecue. Let me try. Let me let you all try it." So he gives them some chopped whole hog, and they taste the barbecue, and they say, "This is the best barbecue we've ever had. You, sir, have built the capital of barbecue." And so after that, Pete Jones started using that phrase, capital of barbecue. He even built a replica of the U.S. Capitol Dome on top of his restaurant, and you can see it from a mile away potentially. It glitters like silvery white in the sun. It's ridiculous looking, but it's beautiful. And that story is not true, or it's only half true. The National Geographic reporters did step in to Pete Jones's barbecue, and he said, "Boys, I have the best barbecue sandwich you've ever had in your life. I own the capital of barbecue." They took his words, put it in print, and after it was in print, then he built his dome.
That's hilarious. Well, that barbecue, it's hard work. No matter which way you slice, dice it, or chop it.
It is brutal work. This whole hog business is brutal, brutal work. It's not your ordinary barbecue. So you're not only cooking like Ricky Parker did from dusk to dawn, but you're working in the smoke-filled pit house. And it is smoke-filled because the hogs require constant shoveling. So you have to shovel fresh hardwood coals under these pigs about every 20 minutes. This is throughout the night. A lot of times, these pigs explode. They're constantly dripping grease on these coals that lie just a foot underneath them. And if this grease catches fire, it can run kind of up, come almost gravitate. The fire gravitates, catches the hog on fire, and will burn the whole pit house down in a matter of minutes. Every single pit house I've been to has burned down.
You were pretty brave because you spent a fair amount of time in there. And there was one particular passage in the book where the smoke alone was just really overwhelming and got to you.
Well, I don't know if I was brave. I mean, I was reporting. And so a lot of the book is about sitting with these pit masters throughout the night, sitting by the fire, staring into the fire, encouraging them to tell me stories, any kind of stories, beyond trying to go beyond barbecue and the process that they do. But, you know, while sitting in these pit houses, I did have to inhale a bunch of smoke. And I would feel unhealthy after a night in these pit houses. A lot of these pit masters have worked in these places, in these smoke houses, for 30, 40, 50 years or more. A lot of them also smoke tobacco. So the existences that they lead they're tough. They're tough guys. They kind of adhere very stubbornly to this tradition.
Ryan, share with us your thoughts on race and barbecue in America, because you came across one particularly offensive racist who almost took his empire down due to his unfortunate thoughts about segregation.
Well, Maurice Bessinger recently passed away, but for a long time, for almost half a century, he ran a barbecue empire out of Columbia, South Carolina. And Maurice was, to call him a complicated man would be unfair to complicated people. He was an outright racist. So you'd walk into his restaurant, and I've been into his restaurant twice, there was this massive portrait of him in a white suit astride a white horse. Next to that would be a stack of books for sale, his biography, which was covered in the Confederate flag. And, you know, it was a book full of race theory. He thought that, segregation of the races was the healthiest thing for the United States. I read this biography. It's horrific. It's no longer for sale, as I understand, in his restaurant since he passed away. But I was always very shocked both times I went by what was for sale, what was on the wall, the shrines to Maurice Bessinger. And there were other pamphlets there about the neo-Confederacy in this. And the diversity not only among the employees, among the staff, but also in the dining room. Among the customers, it was a very strange experience, and to me, it made the barbecue not taste good. I couldn't like leave that place thinking, "Oh, this was a good meal." But he did build an empire. It is a very popular chain of restaurants. He has his own sauce.
Well, you eloquently describe sort of having to swallow a bit of nausea just to get in the door there. You know, he's just going to hit every nerve in the book, isn't he?
Yeah. And I mean, the heart of the book is this chapter about a man named Keith Ward. Keith Ward goes by the name of Pop, and he cooks at a place in Goldsboro, North Carolina, called Wilbur's Barbecue. He's an African-American man, and he's very aware of this history. He's been working at Wilbur's for over three decades. His father has been there for over 50 years. He still works there one day a week. He's in his 80s, his father. And Keith and I talked about race and barbecue. He was very open to sharing. He was very open to talking about what he thinks is unfair and what I, you know, came around to thinking was unfair. Mr. Wilbur is immensely famous in that part of the Carolinas. Keith Ward is nameless. He's anonymous. Keith Ward's face is not on the walls of Wilbur's Barbecue. But all the celebrities that Mr. Wilbur Shirley has fed over the years, all the presidents that have visited his restaurant are on the walls. But Keith and his father are completely absent. And there's something very wrong there. Is it about race? Maybe. You know, I think it's a lot about restaurant culture, a lot about work culture in America. It's a lot about the South. But it is no different in the North. I think it's indicative of what really goes on in between the back of the house and the front of the house in restaurants.
Well, bravo to you for doing this research and bringing all these people's stories to the forefront. I can only imagine all the pitmasters, present and past, and all of the great steak folks gone on to meet their maker who are smiling at you and your beautiful book. Thank you, Ryan. Thanks so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Poppy. This was wonderful.
Ryan Fertel, author of One True Barbecue.
I got a kind-hearted woman. Anything that's worth for me.
When we come back from a short break, we talk cured meats with author Jeff Roberts. Stay tuned.
I see the United women, and they will not let me be. I love my baby. My baby don't love me.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and from Ralph's on the Park, featuring Chef Chip Flanagan's globally influenced New Orleans cuisine overlooking City Park. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch and private events at 900 City Park Avenue in New Orleans, Mid-City.
My name is Jeff Roberts. And I am the author of Salted and Cured, Savoring the Culture, Heritage, and Flavor of America's Preserved Meats.
Like craft beer and fermented cheese, the resurgence of interest in preserved meats has made things like andouille and prosciutto hot items on restaurant menus. But the practice of salt curing meats isn't just a fad. It was once essential to humanity's survival. In his book, Salted and Cured, Jeff Roberts follows the origin of preserved meats from the dawn of time to its current renaissance.
Preserved meats is part of a much bigger universe of preserved foods. Whether we're talking about preserving grain or grain in a liquid form, which we call beer, cheese, a different way of understanding milk in a solid form, and then preserved meats, which, you know, which one of them comes first is very, very difficult to tell. But it's very clear that early humans are using things like smoke just to preserve their meat. Humans don't survive unless we figure out thousands of years ago how to preserve a food for changes in the season or when times were really difficult and the harvest didn't come in. If we didn't figure this out, we wouldn't be here. And they, through literally thousands of years of trial and error, figure out how to make all of this happen and create not only foods for survival, but foods that really taste good for the most part. I've had an interest in fermentation and preservation for quite a long time, but the research opened my eyes to things that I just wasn't prepared for.
What was the most provocative thing that you discovered?
I'm talking about everything from people painting pictures of hogs to language, Latin. There are more words in Latin for hogs than there are for anything else. And then as the language evolves, how some of these terms that have several thousand year history, we still use today. And that, to me, was really eye-opening.
Well, at what point does preservation become an art instead of a necessity?
I'm not sure I can give you an exact answer. My sense is that it becomes an art several thousand years ago. Because once we figure out, for example, with cheese, when you move from a lactic coagulated cheese like feta, for example, or a fresh chèvre, to a rennet cheese, which requires an totally different approach to working with your milk, we then can begin to create different types of cheese. And my sense is that this is also what went on with preservation of meat.
How do you see that country-style ham is perhaps something that's very au courant, very much of a big deal now,
yes,
when in fact it's something that almost became extinct?
That's right. And there's a real tension around this. Number one, everybody's putting up food in the late fall, early winter, whether we're putting up grain or beer or whiskey or a country ham, we had to do this. In fact, some of these farmers would have their neighbors would donate food, and they'd get a little chunk of the animal at the after the slaughter. So everyone's doing it. Maybe you had three or four that you had curing, and over time, the country store would do this. People would bring in a ham and they would trade it for goods, and so the country store owner would do some curing. But we begin to see the loss of some of these beginning in the late 19th century. First of all, we got people moving off farms. And then we have businesses who can, it's more efficient for them to cure 50 rather than you just do a couple. Second World War, after the war, a lot of people, they went out of business. The interstates were built. Nobody's traveling those old country roads anymore. Hey, I can go to the supermarket. I can buy a fresh ham made by Smithfield. I don't need that country ham anymore. What I think that has driven this in the right direction was an interest beginning in the 80s and certainly taking off in the 90s around great Italian food and the place of a great prosciutto on a charcuterie plate or even a pizza. And chefs that traveled to many of these companies, they were interested in bacon, and they literally would carve a little piece off of a ham. And the producers say, wait, you can't do that. That's not cooked. And they would look at them and say, it doesn't have to be cooked. It's cured. It's just like prosciutto. The danger that I see is our elevating this wonderful country ham to simply a white tablecloth, and it loses its cultural roots. Couple of the people that I write about, I worry because they are still doing this the same way they used to. They're not charging $75 to $100 a pound. They're charging a hell of a lot less because that's what they would do. And people keep encouraging them, oh, you should charge more. Well, I'll lose my customers. There's a real tension. John T. Edge at Southern Foodways has identified this as a real risk when we take a food that had valuable cultural, economic, social purpose besides feeding us, and now the only place we ever see this is on a white tablecloth restaurant. If that can help drive interest in creating products on the farms or in a community in a rural area, I'm in favor of that. But I worry about some of these people who have been keeping these traditions who maybe, just can't manage it anymore.
Well, speaking of white tablecloth restaurants, I was particularly heartened to find my friend Nathaniel Zimmet from Boucherie and, of course, his adorable little next-door place, Bouret, in your book. And I was wondering if you would talk to me a bit about Nathaniel and how you see his place in the world.
I think he is an innovative, very conscientious chef who really, you know, he made it very clear that part of his reason for being, for doing what he does, is because he wants to give to the city and he wants to give to the farmers who supply him. That this is a collaboration. It's a partnership between chefs, restaurants, farmers, and consumers, retailers, especially the top-end retailers, to nurture local economy, to nurture the cultural traditions. And so he's playing with some of those traditions, which is, you know, I think is just wonderful. But he has his roots. Just about every one of the people that I talked with, they all had their roots or talked about what they learned about their roots in Louisiana or New Orleans and how that comes about on their menu. And I think the restaurant community is making a very, very important statement and how all of the people of the city benefit from this kind of cultural diversity and vibrancy. Whether we're talking music or food, art, that to me is part of what New Orleans is about.
Jeff Roberts, author of Salted and Cured, Savoring the Culture, Heritage, and Flavor of America's Preserved Meats. In Shreveport, a recently opened barbecue joint called Flying Pig Barbecue is getting a lot of buzz these days. That might be because the proprietor is Carolyn Simmons, longtime pitmaster and winner of the James Beard Foundation's Better Burger Project. On a recent visit to Shreveport, we asked Carolyn to explain the process of how she prepares smoked meat.
I am fascinated by meat. I don't, you know, other people want to go to the grocery store and buy all pretty and nice and groomed. I want to get the biggest, hairiest piece of meat. And I say hairy because I love a live animal that I have to butcher down myself. And I want to take every piece of that meat and look at it and say, what should this be? You know, I love the term nose to tail because I think I was nose to tail before I ever heard the term. And because I love meat, I grew up in a Southern Baptist, very conservative family where I kept saying, Dad, let me grill. And he said, no, told my brother, Chuck, get over here. You help me grill. So I started teaching myself how to grill when I was in my mid-20s. And I started burning meat, just like I talk about burning food. I'm an avid reader, and I read every book on barbecuing, and I talked to everyone I know. Then one day I read about smoking meat and I thought, this is pretty darn cool. So I bought a little aluminum pan and I was soaking wood and putting wood in it and kind of setting it to the side and figuring out what to do with it. And my love of smoking meat grew into the fact that now I get to do it for a living, which is a pretty amazing thing. One thing I like to do, I like to get the full chuck, you know, the big 25 pound, and I cut it up, you know, depending upon what it's in the mood to be that day. And whatever I have left of it, and usually I have about 12 to 14 pounds left, I have a coffee rub that I put espresso coffee on, and I rub it with this. And then I always catch my renderings when I smoke meat. So I take all my beef renderings from the day before, and I inject it, and I let it sit there and come up to room temperature, and I smoke that. And that's what I make into my chopped beef. And that is the best chopped beef sandwich you will ever taste. And then also I grind my own sausage. And, you know, I do a lot of pork and there's a lot of fat left over from pork. So I use some of my extra, you know, your renderings. Whenever you're cutting up meat, there's always pieces you cut off and you think it's waste. Nothing is ever waste. It's sausage. So I take that sausage and I smoke it. And if I have breakfasts, and I do a lot of catering. So when people get a catered breakfast from me, they're getting all my scraps from all my meat. And we're not wasting anything. And then I smoke it in my smokehouse, so it's nice smoky sausage.
Do you have a preferred wood that you smoke with?
Oh, definitely. I feel very strongly about wood. We have a lot of local hickory here, so when people cut down hickory trees, they know I'm constantly searching for hickory. They'll bring me, I've got a guy who cuts it up, they'll bring me their hickory. So I try to use only Louisiana hickory. And then in Mansfield, there's a pecan orchard, and they have all these leftover shells after they shell their pecans. So I use their pecan shells. I sometimes use applewood and things, too. I bring in a little bit of wood that's not local because some things I want to be a little more delicate. But most of my meat is smoked with local Louisiana hickory and Louisiana pecan shells.
Sauce, the eternal question. You've already told us about your preferred rub.
Right.
How do you feel about sauces?
Well, I love sauces. They're so much fun. And like, I bought some Hatch peppers the other day. So guess what sauce I'm making tomorrow? I'm going to make a barbecue sauce with Hatch chili peppers in it. You know, to me, things should change seasonally. And I think right now we've got these great peppers, so my sauce changes. I do put my renderings back into my barbecue sauces. And then I used to put molasses, but I found that there's a company just across the border in Texas. So, you know, I try to only use Louisiana but you know, sometimes you got to use Texas products. But they don't extract their molasses out of their sugar. They leave it in. So it's a really dark, rich sugar, molasses sugar. So I put that in all of my sauces. And then we have a local brewery here called Great Raft, and I use their dark, rich beers that I put in my sauce because I think you gotta put beer in a barbecue sauce.
Barbecue expert Carolyn Simmons of Flying Pig Barbecue in Shreveport.
Barbecue sauce differ from state to state? Stay tuned, and when we come back, we'll take you along on the Southern Barbecue Sauce Trail. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from French Market Coffee. French Market Coffee's premium blended beans are locally roasted in small batches, creating a coffee that can only be called New Orleans Bold. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. How does barbecue sauce differ from state to state? Vinegar, tomato, and mustard are the elements that all define regional barbecue. Vinegar-based sauces are essentially refined basting liquids, the origin of all barbecue sauces. In Lexington, Kentucky, they prefer a vinegar and pepper-based sauce with tomato paste or ketchup to thicken and sweeten the vinegar base. In the mid-20th century, tomato-based sauce became the American standard, a runny, sweet and sour sauce with a kick of pepper that dominates Memphis and St. Louis barbecue. As 20th century barbecue marches on, commercial tomato and sugar sauces take on a life of their own. Unfortunately, as they really overpower the smoky meat. South Carolina is also known as the mustard belt. That's because they prefer a sauce much edgier than their tomato-based cousin. The intense concoction of yellow mustard, vinegar, and seasonings is South Carolina's choice for saucing whole hog barbecue. No matter which sauce you prefer, barbecue cooked low and slow makes for some good Louisiana Eats.
My name is Nathaniel Zimmet, and I am the chef and owner of Boucherie and Bouret.
The extensive task of taking apart a whole hog is something that many would find arduous or, frankly, gross. For Nathaniel Zimmet, however, it's an obsession. We join Nathaniel in his kitchen and observe the award-winning chef as he gleefully deconstructed a whole hog.
So we get two hogs a week, and what we do with the meat is we sell it at Bouret in different forms, and we also use it at Boucherie. One thing I try to consider, Bouret is like Boucherie's butcher shop, and so we get to really have this benefit of a whole cooler dedicated to Boucherie. And we get to really begin flavors. For instance, if we're making a gumbo and we make the andouille, that is something that I'm able to direct the flavor from the very beginning. You know, I'm not relying upon somebody else's sausage. I'm relying upon what I want to do. It's wild to get a whole animal in and put it on your board and say, what do I want to do today? Really, we're limited by our imagination. We have the space. We have the ability to do anything.
Well, let's take the pig apart and tell me what you imagine is going to happen with all bits of this pig.
So we look at it, and one thing we look immediately is kind of the size of it. So the hanging weight is 266. It was probably a good 300 pounds. It's a big boy. So
first things first,
I start looking at the excessive amount of fat. This is this leaf fat. This is stuff that we use. We break this down. We render. We sell lard as well. And we use lard. I don't always use my knife for this. Reason being is there's natural kind of breaks in meat, and that's, you know, the different muscles. And the different muscles will have connective tissue or something, and I can usually kind of snake my finger into it. Whereas my knife hopefully is sharp, and if it's sharp, it doesn't necessarily know the difference between fat and meat. So after I took off the big leaf, I start looking around for flank steaks. Flank steaks are the forgotten cut of meat on a pig, in my opinion. They're so amazing. You think about them as you would a skirt or a flank steak from a cow, and they're every bit as good. They're tender. They're wonderful.
Yeah, and it's amazing, really, what a small piece of meat that is, generally speaking. So,
and we generate a few of them. So there's one here, and really, you start to, when you start to pretend and you look at this whole animal and you pretend that I don't know what this is, I can start breaking down muscle to muscle to muscle. And imagine how many muscles there are on your belly, you know, and that's what this is. It's just a matter of how you look at it. If you look at it differently, you can really see something else. I'm looking at that and it just doesn't, you can see by the grain, it just doesn't look like it wants to be there. It's saying, Nathaniel, please, please, kick me off. It's easy. And then I am forever mindful of this guy right here. This is our tenderloin. And so that will be coming out next.
That's the money meat, right?
That is the money meat. So take this guy off. And again, I really try to do very little to these muscles. I try to just follow the outsides and let my fingers kind of do a little scouting before my knife does. And then, again, look how easily it just comes right off.
Beautiful. Nathaniel, when did you butcher your first hog?
Oh, the first time I butchered a whole hog by myself was in this kitchen. And it was a huge, huge animal. And I remember it was a Monday and we were closed, and I had a bunch of my employees were here, friends, and I remember squeezing a nipple and milk shooting out of it, and that cleared the room, and then I was able to have peace with my animal. But that was...
Yeah, that'll clear a room.
That was 08. That was 08 probably was the first time. And it's been many, many since. So that's our beautiful little tenderloin. Yes. It is nice. So start taking off this guy. I'm gonna grab this little flank just because I see it and it's calling my name and it's saying, just please remove me. and then I'll take this back boy off. So what I'll do is I'll go straight down and kind of just try to be as straight as I can. This is my sweet baby, this knife right here. I have a semi full-blown knife addiction.
Yes,
I always relate. Have. this is a Tanaka, it's a Yodeba. A Yodeba's a Japanese butchery knife. It's slightly smaller than a Deba, and this one, you know, it's flat on one side and has a pretty pronounced secondary angle on the front.
Gorgeous.
It is a beast, and this thing is not, it gets razor sharp, and it's not something that I'm concerned with breaking bones with. And I'll let this beautiful knife do its work. I get my guide cuts.
And it is really beautiful because it follows the natural pattern. There's this beautiful curvature that people who are accustomed to seeing whole fresh hams in a store even would recognize.
It's beautiful. It really is. And honestly, this is, I don't know, when we opened up Bouray, for years, this was part of what my plan has been, is to have a butcher shop. I remember when I first moved into town, I was cooking. I think I was a sous chef at the Bank Cafe under Dan Essis, an awesome guy. And I was working my ass off, but I saw that in the paper, Jeans Po' Boys had a position for a butcher, and I applied. And they sat me down and interviewed me, and dude is like, why do you want to work here? And I was like, I really like butchery. I want to just get better at it. I'm really interested. He's like, we don't really get in whole animals. You're just going to be making a lot of sausage. And I'm like, that sounds so cool. And he just looks at me, and he had another guy with him, and they just are staring at me like I'm an idiot. And they're like, what's your angle? Like, what are you trying to do? And I'm like, I'm just trying to work as a butcher part-time while I'm cooking. And long story short, they never call me back. So I make these lead cuts with my knife. My knife is sharp and it doesn't rip meat. And I try to get as much around that bone as I can, and then I start cutting. And I use the saw very little at this point, and you can hear it went right through.
Now, I think a lot of people would expect to hear the whirring of a bandsaw, but no, we've just got a regular old handsaw here.
Yeah,
huh?
These things work really well. It's just all
available at any Ace Hardware store.
I bought this
at
Lowe's. Lowe's, a shop I attend frequently. So, here we are.
It's so interesting because what you're doing now, taking the skin off that pig trotter, it looks like you're just peeling the glove off some lady.
That is exactly why a lot of this traditional charcuterie stuff came about, because you're taking it apart and you're like, why am I not restuffing that glove?
So you get turned away from the poor boy shop when they were alarmed that you were so excited about sausage making. Are you largely self-taught? Or how'd you learn this, Nathaniel?
Well, I went to culinary school, the Le Cordon Bleu in London and in Sydney, and certainly that, when I did that, a light bulb went off. I mean, things immediately clicked. I dropped out of university to go to culinary school, and just things immediately clicked. Butchery is an interesting thing. There's so many wonderful books. There's so many really crappy books on charcuterie and whole animal butchery. They're predominantly horrible books, which is so disappointing. But you just, you know, practice makes perfect. No, you know, I don't think I've ever had somebody really watch over me when I'm butchering a pig to teach me.
What's going to happen with that pigtail? I see you've saved it.
The pigtail goes often to my dog. She's quite a loved, huge animal. She weighs 170 pounds, and she just turned 3.
Oh, my goodness. What is she?
She's an American Mastiff. Strangely enough, her name is Kikuichi. After the first knife that I held that really felt like it was right.
That's great.
There you go. There you go. True story.
It's all about your tools, isn't it?
It is all about the tools. I'm going to come right back to this and that cut, and I'm going to start working on getting my loin out of there, getting it out of harm's way. And it's interesting, and sometimes I don't always do this the same way. there are many ways to butcher. And I don't necessarily, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a right way. You really always need to consider what you're doing with it. And you can never be too humble in when you're doing this kind of stuff. And always recognizing that this is what it's all about. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm really good at this, I can do this real fast. You know what? Congratulations. Just don't screw up the meat. I always make bacon or corned pork belly. So I almost always keep this centerpiece, as I talked about. And even trimming with meaty bones, I still have a lot of belly left. This is our chicharrón, and that will be our lardo. This will be cleans down for that. And here is heaven.
What's heaven on a pig?
Heaven is that pig belly. So let's look at it, and let's look at the edges. The edges really tell the story here, and it tells me what to do with my knife. So look at the side. This is, what does that look like?
Looks like bacon.
Looks like bacon to me too. We look at this side, and we're still in a pretty fat town.
Yeah.
And then this here, the other side, is kind of all over the place. It is technically belly-ish, but really, we just wouldn't do that. And then you have this side, again, fat. So, if you recall, this is where I was taking all those flanks off of. And you really say, oh, I really don't need that. So what I'm gonna do first, and this one is still available, I am gonna take that one off. What I like to do is I like to take the first ones that kind of gets me cleaned up, if you will. And then, as I'm getting more into my pig, and knowing, you know, figuring out exactly what I need for the week, and what I'm doing, then I'll recognize that I have all these other options, and maybe a flank will pop out again. So, I'll take a couple of cuts. The other thing to think about, too, is where you're in your belly. Like, this is too much meat. This is a 2-inch thick part of the belly, and literally almost 50% meat, and it's marbled meat, and then another 50% of fat. That 50% of fat is, so it's one thing of meat, or protein, another part of fat, and it's one on top of the other, so that's a problem. Whereas I look on this side, and I've got meat, fat. I want that. That looks like bacon. And that is wonderful time to end.
The pig. What an incredible job you did here and for us. I'm so grateful. Thank you, Nathaniel.
You're very welcome.
Nathaniel Zimmet, chef and owner of Boucherie and Bure. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week as we examine the world of culinary collecting.
One of my favorite attributes of collectors is this overwhelming sense of guilt. They swear to themselves that if they just buy this one more thing, they'll never do it again.
Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Where you can also subscribe to the podcast and take us with you wherever you go. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from the Palace Cafe, home of crab meat cheesecake, white chocolate bread pudding, and the Black Duck Bar, sporting the largest rum collection in New Orleans, located in the historic Worldline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook as well. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.